بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إنك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
Russia hits back at the U.S. president, saying it's not for Biden to decide whether President Putin can remain in power. Ukraine's president repeats his call for more Western military aid and asks Europeans whether they're afraid of Russia. And Yemen suspending missile and drone strikes against Saudi Arabia for 3 days to give peace a chance. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the U.S. president raising eyebrows after suggesting that his Russian counterpart should not remain in office.
We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principle, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
Now, in response, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that the Russian president is elected by the people of Russia and that it's not up to Biden to decide who should be in power in that country. The White House later explained that Biden wasn't calling for regime change in Russia. It said that the U.S. president meant to say that Putin cannot be allowed to exercise power over its neighbors or the region. Now, political commentator Lawrence Davidson says Biden's comments about the Russian leader are looking a lot like those his predecessor Donald Trump would make.
It's embarrassing, actually, to have this man who really is a rather simple-minded fellow running around and destroying the basis for reconciliation and continuing ordinary diplomatic relations with Russia, because he, you know, by saying these things and alienating the Russian government, I mean, it'll make it harder in the end to bring back a normal relations. And actually, Biden sounds a lot like Trump. I mean, after all, Donald Trump had gone around the country saying, Mr. Biden shouldn't be in office.
Now, President Zelensky of Ukraine is urging Western states to provide his country with weapons and military hardware so that it could defend itself against Russian attacks.
What is the price of this security? This is very, very specific. It is planes for Ukraine. It is tanks for our state. It is missile defense. It is anti-ship weapons. That is what our partners have. That is what is just gathering dust there. After all, this is all not only for the freedom of Ukraine, but for the freedom of Europe.
Speaking of the video address on Saturday, Zelensky said that Ukraine is asking for just a tiny fraction of NATO's arms, not more. He also asked Europeans whether they're afraid of Moscow and warned again that Russia's military operation could endanger the whole Europe. Zelensky insists that Russia will seek to expand further into Europe if Ukraine falls. But NATO does not back his request for a no-fly zone on the grounds that it could provoke a wider war. Early in the day, Zelensky talked to his Polish counterpart and demanded a rapid transfer of Russian-made fighter aircraft from Eastern Europe to Ukraine to be used against Russian troops. Britain is striking a conciliatory tone toward Russia. London says its sanctions can be lifted if Moscow commits to a full ceasefire and withdraws its troops from Ukraine. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss says for the sanctions to be removed, Russia must also give assurances that it will not attack Ukraine again. Now, the comments echo recent remarks by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that the wide-ranging penalties against Russia can go away if Moscow changes its behavior. Now, Blinken says that the sanctions are not designed to be permanent. The West has imposed an array of sanctions on Russia, but 1 month into the war, the Kremlin says it will continue the offensive until it accomplishes its goals of demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine. Okay, that was all about Ukraine. For now, in other news, Yemen announcing a unilateral ceasefire, suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia. It reaffirms the readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Now, Mashat says that Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He says that Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says that Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to the Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. Now, developments follow the Yemeni armies targeting multiple locations deep inside Saudi Arabia, including an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and vital sites in the capital, Riyadh. Okay, now, from Sana, let's bring in Hossein al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator. Good to have you with us, Mr. Bukhaiti. So tell us what the situation is like. And the Yemenis have just started, as you know, and I just announced after the attack on Aramco, they are now embarking on a ceasefire. And now they're waiting to see what the Saudis are doing, right?
Yeah, this is exactly actually what happened. The Saudi, as soon as Mr. Mashat has announced the 3 days ceasefire, Saudi has conducted a widespread airstrike against areas in Sana'a, in Sa'da, in Marib, and as well in Hudaydah, killing and injuring dozens of Yemeni civilians. And I believe that Yemeni, to be honest with you, this announcement I think is a mistake, because how can you announce a ceasefire against an enemy that does not consider himself as a part of this war? We know that Saudi Arabia is still calling what's happening in Yemen as a civil war, as well the United Nations is the same. They have never ever named Saudi as a great part in this war. That's why I think that Yemenis should not give Saudi any time, especially after this latest attack against Saudi Arabia. If they have continued this attack on a daily basis, I believe that the Saudi will be forced into signing an agreement with Sana'a directly and withdrawing their troops from Yemen and lifting the blockade. But to be honest, it's silly that after a major attack against Saudi Arabia, we hear some kind of those announcement coming from Sana'a. They have announced ceasefire dozens of times since the war has begun, and Saudi always responds by killing civilians, by tightening their blockade, and as well by conducting a major airstrike against many areas in Yemen. That's why I believe that Yemeni army should take up the step and they should stop any negotiation, and as well they should continue attack against Saudi Arabia, because now Sana'a is the one who bear the full responsibility for any civilians that has been killed. It's not the Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is our enemy. Of course, they will continue to kill Yemeni civilians, but Yemeni government is responsible for saving and protecting Yemeni civilians, and the only way to do so is by targeting and continue targeting Saudi vital infrastructure like they did in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Mr. Bukhari, this might be a good chance for hostilities to stop, because the Yemenis have announced a ceasefire. And what about the UN and other international bodies or countries or the Saud-led coalition? Are they not showing any reaction to push the Saudis into at least stopping this, as the Yemenis have done, and sit at the negotiating table to resolve issues?
I mean, the UN is exactly the same stand as Saudi Arabia. They have not responded to these truce. They have not called Saudi Arabia to stop its attack. The only times they call in a truce is by asking Sana'a to stop attacking against Saudi Arabia. They consider Saudi as not a part of this war. That's why the whole international community actually is standing with Saudi Arabia. The UN, as an example, the blockade that has been enforced on Yemen for the last for more than 7 years, United Nations has never ever condemned the Saudi. They have not called the Saudi to lift the blockade, or at least to leave the ships and oil tanker that has been searched by the United Nations, which has been given a green light for them to enter Hodeidah port. This is actually a crime to block fuel and food from coming into a country, despite the matter with the situation on the ground. And that's why United Nations actually is playing a huge part in this war against Yemen. We remember that in the first 2 years of the war, United Nations has named the Saudi as a child and put them in a shame list for killing children. But after that, they have actually removed Saudi because of pressure and blackmail from Saudi Arabia toward the United Nations, that they will stop funding its programs. And at that time, we remember that in the second year, United Nations actually in the same report has thanked Saudi Arabia for avoiding killing children. And on the other hand, we see that Saudi has killed directly by airstrike about 19,000 Yemeni civilians. And by informing the blockade, they have killed more than 400 Yemeni civilians. There are about 400 Yemeni children who suffer from acute severe malnutrition. According to UNICEF, this is all because Saudi is blocking food and fuel from coming into Yemen. That's why I believe that United Nations, Sana'a, should cut all its contact with the United Nations. They should not set up any one-side ceasefire, because Saudi only will accept and will respect you only when you show Saudi your strength. And this won't only happen by attacking Saudi Arabia really hard, and we should not give them time to think how to defend themselves. They should have continued those attack against Aramco like they did in the last 2 and 3 weeks.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator in Yemeni capital, Sana'a. In a rare public message of support, Israel extended its sympathies to Saudi Arabia following a barrage of Yemeni strikes on multiple targets across the kingdom. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett expressed Israel's sorrow to Riyadh over the attack, which he described as horrific. He was referring to a wave of missile and drone strikes that a Yemeni army conducted on several sites deep inside Saudi Arabia on the 7th anniversary of the war 2 days ago. The strikes caused a huge fire at an Aramco oil storage facility in Jeddah. The Tel Aviv regime has no formal relations with Saudi Arabia, but the UAE and Bahrain, both allies of Riyadh, normalized relations with Israel 2 years ago. In January, Tel Aviv offered security and intelligence support to the UAE after a deadly Yemeni strike hit its capital, Abu Dhabi. Now moving on, France's presidential election has been unlike any other recent memory, with apathy and disinterest dominating headlines. It's the first major vote in the West since the end of the coronavirus, and that may explain why France appears unusually politically disoriented. Rami Mazari has more from Paris.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression.
We are here to protest against the abusive government and this kingship presidency of Emmanuel Macron. The Yellow Vests are here to promote a true vision of democracy and to redistribute our nation's wealth. Every election there is more and more abstention because people don't believe in mainstream politics anymore.
In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the Yellow Vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun. An unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
Now, the Iranian foreign minister says that resuming talks to remove sanctions against his country remains on the government's agenda. Hossein Amir Abdullahi was speaking in a televised interview with IRIB. He said an agreement is close, but key outstanding issues first need to be resolved. The Iranian official said that any possible outcome will not go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Now, the comments came as the European Union's coordinator for the talks, Enrique Mora, is set to visit Tehran on Sunday to settle the unresolved issues. Iran says it's ready for a good deal if Washington removes the sanctions in a verifiable way. Tehran demands guarantees that there will be no more withdrawal by the U.S. from the deal as it did in 2018. Israeli crop duster planes have sprayed toxic herbicides on Gaza's farmlands as Tel Aviv continues inhumane acts of aggression against the impoverished coastal enclave. Farmers in Gaza Strip see no end in sight to their suffering as Israel continues to destroy their crops. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops. Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices. Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers. Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Women's role in making Nowruz happy. In In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Women are the symbol of generation, love and prosperity in the Iranian culture. A woman spreads pure love and affection in the entire home. A mother spreads the red cloth eagerly. She is zealous as she wants to set the half-seen tablecloth in the best shape. She has already washed apples, cleaned the extra peels of garlic, prepared samanu pudding, sumac, oleaster, and vinegar, and has also green sprouts and put them on the tablecloth. She has also put a few coins in a small plate. Then she brings a mirror and a copy of the Noble Quran with hyacinth flowers. Then her daughter brings the fish bowl to complete the tablecloth. The mother hugs her daughter and smiles at her. There is a beautiful saying that when a mother smiles as if all bricks of the house smile, the joy and loveliness of every house depends on the woman in it. Although she is called as the fair sex, she is stronger than any man in spreading love and mercy at home. In verse 21 of chapter Rum of Quran, God says, "And of his signs is that he created for you mates from your own selves, that you may take comfort in them, and he ordained affection and mercy between you. There are indeed signs in that for a people who reflect." The verse that you just heard indicates that marriage is a sacred thing and God has ordained a special calm in marriage for man and woman. Anyway, one of the methods of women for creating calm at home is to make happy moments. This is more obvious in feasts such as Nowruz. Iranian women start their activities before the arrival of Nowruz. They first call on their husband and children, kindly help her clean the house. Then they put out any extra or useless item. This helps diminish stress and brings about tranquility. Women usually try to change the decoration of the house by changing the places of different things. They make various sweets and pastries. Women enthusiastically set the half-seen tablecloth, and some of them even do embroideries on the tablecloth. Some others make different dishes for the items of the tablecloth. A few women also make samanu for half-seen tablecloth. In short, it is women who make Nowruz happier and more memorable. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "No doubt, the role of a mother's skills as the administrator of home and family cannot be ignored for bringing about the spiritual serenity and the sense of liveliness. The administration of happiness at home is mainly the responsibility of parents, but a mother plays a more important role in this regard due to the management of the house affairs. She is the emotional support of the family. However, she needs the reciprocal emotions of family members. A mother is the access for everyone to confabulate. If the mother is happy, she can bring up happy and strong children. Nowruz is the best opportunity to consolidate family bonds and relations between children and parents. Yet, it is the mother who can act as pioneer." One of the problems of modern world for mothers is stress. Psychologists believe that the shortest way for making women happy is to decrease their stress. They maintain that man's supportive role for women and their mutual respect play a very important role in this connection. A man, via his all-out support for the family, particularly his wife, can remove her stress and provide her calm. Man's lovely word to his wife is very effective in decreasing of stress. Imam Reza, peace upon him, the 18th infallible successor of Prophet of Islam, says, "Whenever a man tells his wife, 'I love you,' a love will be created in the wife's heart, which will never get out of her heart. Verbal expression of love by man will light the fire of love in woman's heart. Then she will give this love to her husband and children. As it has been proved, mutual respect between couples will cause happiness in life. Politeness and respect will diminish stress and anxieties at home, and children will be brought up away from humiliation and disregard. Nowruz is the time for expression of love. At the moment of turn of the year, family members exchange kisses and give gifts to one another to increase love and happiness. In short, women play the most important and most beautiful role in creation of happiness in Nowruz and other times."
On behalf of myself and all of my colleagues here at Arabi English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
Jean-Luc Brunel, a famous French model scout and fashion industry figure, has been found dead in his prison cell in what appears to be a suicide. Brunel was a close associate of infamous billionaire and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who was also supposed to have hung himself in his cell. We've heard about Epstein and the sex trafficking and the victims who've come forward, but why has the media said nothing about the blackmailing aspect that Epstein and his close associate Ghislaine Maxwell were using underage girls to gather dirt on politicians so they could blackmail them? And what about the relationship to Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad? Today, we're going to try and answer these questions and look at the saga a little more carefully. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On Saturday, February 19th, 2022, Jean-Luc Brunel, a prominent French model scout, was found dead in his cell in La Santé prison in what has been called a suicide. Now, you might be wondering, why should this be of any particular interest? Because Brunel was not just a big figure in the fashion industry, he was also a close associate of billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Brunel stands accused of sexual assault and having partaken in alleged sex trafficking ring run by Epstein. To be frank, he was providing young girls to Epstein for sex. And for lack of a better word, he was a pimp. Now, according to one of the victims, Virginia Gouffre, Epstein admitted to her that he had, quote, slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls. And it was from Virginia Gouffre's civil suit against Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, that we know of Brunel's name as well. And this is one day that we see these court documents unsealed, one day before Jeffrey Epstein's death. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was known for living a lavish life and always inviting very prominent figures like actors and high-level politicians and businessmen to fly around with him on his private jet. And so Jeffrey Epstein would go and invite these people to his private islands, right, where they would have intercourse with underage girls that he had trafficked through his associates such as Maxwell or Brunel, who were running these fashion and model agencies where they would get these girls from. And so following the revelations of this scandal, you know, people are starting to wonder, are these prominent figures, the politicians, the actors, all of these people we see in the photographs with Epstein, did they also participate in this sex trafficking ring? Because many of their names appear on the flight logs of Jeffrey Epstein's private jets. One of those names is, of course, Jean-Luc Brunel. The flight logs list him as a passenger 25 times on Epstein's private plane. And so who exactly was Jeffrey Epstein, the real Jeffrey Epstein? And why are there so many secrets surrounding this whole case? Now, back in 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty for soliciting a minor for prostitution. He served 13 months in jail. But unlike most prisoners who have to stay in prison, Epstein was given the luxury of being able to work out of his office 6 days a week. Now, one of the women who has come forward to accuse Epstein of sexual assault is Maria Farmer. When Maria Farmer was just a young art student, Epstein bought one of her paintings. She was recruited to work as his art advisor. And Farmer claims that Epstein showed her an entire system of secret video surveillance that he had set up inside his property with cameras in the bedrooms and the toilets. Now, Farmer was the first victim to officially report Epstein's behavior and abuse to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. However, at the time, you know, the authorities just didn't seem to take her accusations seriously, and there was no investigation. When Ghislaine Maxwell found out that Farmer had paid a visit to the FBI, she began threatening her with physical violence.
What sort of threats has she made against you?
Originally, it started with things like, I'm going to burn your art, and then I'm going to burn your career, and then I'm going to burn you and the house you live in. And then it was, oh, be careful crossing a street. You know, you can get shot in the back of the head. You know, they were threats against my life, and I told the FBI this.
It wasn't just Maxwell, Brunel, and Epstein doing this. The victims have also accused many high-level officials, billionaires, professors, even the British royal family, Prince Andrew, of having partaken in this sex trafficking. Epstein provided them with young girls, which they abused. Now, earlier, I talked about the flight logs and how Brunel's name appears there. But you might be more familiar with former U.S. President Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, whose names appear multiple times on Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was finally arrested on July 6, 2019, on federal charges for sex trafficking minors, and he pleaded not guilty. They then put Epstein in New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as MCC, and they put him on suicide watch because he reportedly tried to take his own life. Now, when you're put under suicide watch, that means you're under 24/7 surveillance. But after an assessment by a high-level psychologist, Epstein was taken out of suicide watch, and they put him instead in a special housing unit, or an SHU. And so barely a month after his arrest, on August 10th at 6:30 a.m., Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his cell by apparent suicide. And it turns out that the guards had fallen asleep and there's no camera footage. And with Brunel's suicide, the same thing. There's no camera footage. The cameras were not working. Now, look, there are many theories floating out there about Epstein's death, specifically because a lot of things don't add up. And even then, Attorney General William Barr, he himself admitted to some, quote, serious irregularities. There are also numerous suicide prevention experts who also expressed serious concern. Senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, Eric Balaban, raised questions as to why Epstein's life was risked by putting him in this restrictive special housing unit, or SHU, specifically when he had shown suicidal tendencies. According to him, an SHU is just not an appropriate thing for someone who's shown recent suicidal tendencies. Now, I can recall as I was attending the extradition hearing of Julian Assange, one of the people testifying was none other than Maureen Baird. Maureen Baird is the former warden of that very prison, MCC, where Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And she spoke about the prison conditions there, specifically about pretrial SAMs. However, she did note one thing, that Jeffrey Epstein was the first person to kill themselves at MCC since 2013. Now, to be honest, I cannot know how, you know, for sure how Jeffrey Epstein died, whether he simply decided to end his life because of all the pressure from the trial and the public exposure and the lengthy sentence awaiting him, or whether he was killed because he was too dangerous and the elites wanted to tie up some loose ends. But let me tell you something that we can verify. This wasn't the first time Jeffrey Epstein was in jail. As we were saying earlier, he was arrested in 2007. But how come he got off so easily? Well, it turns out that Alexander Acosta was the Miami Attorney General at the time. And while he was being interviewed a couple of years later for the position of Labor Secretary by Donald Trump's transition team, Acosta revealed that, quote, "I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone." And now you see why he cut Jeffrey Epstein a non-prosecution plea deal. If all of this wasn't enough, you know, all of this horrible sex trafficking, it also seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel had ties to at least Israeli intelligence, if not also American intelligence. You know, Epstein had been known to brag about working for the Mossad, and Acosta just gives him a slap on the wrist because he knows that he's working with intelligence. Now, Epstein's longtime partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, is known to have been both a KGB and Mossad agent. You see, Robert Maxwell was a very, very famous media tycoon who owned 6 national newspapers in the UK. He also famously stole around £500 million from his own workers' pension funds. Now, journalist Whitney Webb, who's done fantastic work on Epstein, she's written extensively about Robert Maxwell's exploits as a Mossad agent in great detail. At one point, for example, Robert Maxwell acquired a company called Information on Demand, which was a front. It was a cutout for the Mossad. And they sold an Israeli piece of software called Promise, right? And this software was sold to governments around the world. And it had a back door inside it, allowing the Israelis to penetrate and spy on the very clients they had sold it to. So Robert Maxwell even sold Promise, this software, to a Los Angeles-based firm called Sandia National Laboratories, which provided Israeli intelligence with direct access to the core of the U.S. nuclear weapons program and nuclear weapons technology. And speaking of nuclear technology, it's also believed that Robert Maxwell is the one who tipped off the Israeli embassy in London about the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, after Vanunu had divulged the existence of Israel's nuclear program to the press. Right, Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped in Rome. They flew him to Israel and then sentenced him to almost 2 decades in prison. And when the issue of Robert Maxwell being a Mossad spy was brought up, because you have to keep in mind, he was also a member of parliament in the UK, so this was quite the scandal. And when this was brought up, no one would print it because the press feared being hit with a libel suit, right? So instead, what happened is George Galloway and Rupert Allison, who were both MPs at the time, they went and raised this issue in the House of Commons, exposing Robert Maxwell as a Mossad spy. And by extension, this allowed the British press to start printing about it without fear of reprisal or fear of being sued by Maxwell and his lawyers. Now, just a few weeks later, mysteriously, Maxwell died after allegedly falling off of his yacht. He was buried. He was buried with full honors at the Mount of Olives. And you know who attended his funeral? The Israeli Prime Minister and President, and at least 6 former and serving heads of the Mossad. Maybe that will give you an idea about how important he was for the Israelis, that all of these figures are attending his funeral. And so that's Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? But if you thought the only connection here to the Mossad was her father, Well, you'd better think again. Journalist Jeff Shalev conducted an interview in 2019 with an individual named Ari Ben Menashe. Ben Menashe was a, quote, Israeli consultant and former arms dealer who also served as a senior executive for Israel's Directorate of Military Intelligence from 1977 to 1987. So this puts Ben Menashe in a unique position to divulge about Epstein and also Maxwell, because he met them both 40 years ago when he was working for Israel alongside Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. And so in this interview, Ben Menashe is asked, quote, "You spoke about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell as being part of Israeli military intelligence. Do you know specifically which unit?" Ben Menashe replies that, quote, "Because of Robert Maxwell, they worked directly with military intelligence. I don't know who they answer to." The interviewer then continues, "Would you say that she was an agent as well and in military intelligence as well?" Ben Menashe says yes, yes to both. And so Ben Menashe also makes another thing very clear, that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the entire point of their sex trafficking operation was to, quote, "blackmail American and other political figures by specifically seeking out underage girls for their friends." And as for Jean-Luc Brunel, he used his modeling agency to traffic girls to Epstein, right? And unsurprisingly, he had an office in where? Tel Aviv, right? An office in Tel Aviv as part of his modeling agency with Epstein. And so here in this picture, you can see Brunel wearing a cap that reads Israel Army. Again, that's perhaps not the most incriminating thing, but do keep it in mind. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Graham Elwood. He's an American comedian, podcaster, and writer. He hosts a progressive YouTube show and podcast called The Political Vigilante. He's also the co-host of Government Secrets with Lee Camp. Graham has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for several years now, which even resulted in his YouTube channel being demonetized. Graham, could you maybe just to start off, give us a very brief overview of the Epstein case in the simplest terms so anyone can get it?
I have a whole Epstein playlist on my YouTube channel. And one of the most critical interviews I would ask people to watch is where I interview a former child crimes investigator, my friend Eric Oldenburg, who was on the Phoenix Police Department for 24 years. And he investigated online, basically, child trafficking and child pornography and pretty gnarly stuff. And I mean, he said, you know, anyone can be a pedophile, any socioeconomic status, any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation. Sexual orientation doesn't even necessarily correlate. He said, but the people that can get away with it the most are the wealthy and most powerful. And that's what the Epstein case is. If you want to understand how the ruling elites operate, start paying attention to the Epstein case, because you've got, in the intelligence community, specifically CIA and Mossad, are their handprints are all over this. And, you know, like with these examples, just some basic stuff. So when Epstein was arrested in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2008, 2009 in that area, Acosta was the prosecutor, and he was told to... Epstein was a CIA asset and to back off. And that's why he gave him a very lenient case, a charge. Basically, he got to leave his prison every day and fly around and literally traffic and abuse girls.
And when you mention powerful people and the ruling elites, you know, you have a lot of pictures, photographs of celebrities and very rich and important personalities that have photographed with Epstein or Maxwell. And we've also heard of this black book full of names. Could you basically tell us what that is and why we see so many important people photographed with Epstein and people related, people in his entourage?
One of the things, and this has been confirmed in other places, one of the things Epstein's would do, he'd have these parties with the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. Billionaires, politicians, I mean, presidents, several different royal families, including the Saudis and the British royal family. And so this powerful person would come in. One of Epstein's butlers would say, hey, would you like a massage from a beautiful young woman? The guy would say yes. And it would be, they'd have sex and it would be a child. And they'd videotape it. Then Epstein would say, well, now I've got evidence of you having sex with a child. And they would then invest in Epstein's. He had some like fake hedge fund. So this is one of the ways Epstein got power. And this is why the intelligence community went, oh, this is an asset, because now we can use these videotapes as leverage. So what is so significant here, Richard, is when Epstein was arrested in July of 2019, we saw the video and the footage of the guys in the FBI coats dragging out, not dragging, but like wheeling out on dolly trucks, boxes of photos, videos, hard drives, all this stuff. None of it. We have seen any of it. So what we have seen is just these little snippets. We've seen like the photos you've seen online. We've seen the flight logs. And I think the flight logs are very critical as well. They show stuff like Bill Clinton on his plane 26 times, Hillary on his plane two times. Trump was originally thought to only be on one time, but more flight logs were released at the end of December during the Maxwell trial, showing Trump was actually on five times. So to your question here, where is that information? Well, that is the reason why this stuff is getting swept under the rug, because the richest, most powerful people are on video. So that's why Jean-Luc Brunel is dead, is because he probably wouldn't play ball or had information or threatened to make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I'll give you these videotapes, give me a lighter sentence. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, he's so distraught, he's going to hang himself. It's believed that Maxwell has so much information, and she's ruthless. She plays hardball, that she has, I don't know, some people will call it like whatever you are, like a kill switch, basically. My belief is, Ghislaine Maxwell said, if I go down, you
sorry
go
to cut
down.
You off. I was going to ask you about the Maxwell trial, about Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, how does she tie into Epstein? What's the relationship, and why is she so important to this case? And what did you make of the trial that took place a few months ago?
We'll call her socialite, Epstein's gal pal, maybe even a recruiter. But according to several Epstein victims, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre, Anne Maria Farmer, and Maria Farmer's sister, Annie Farmer, she participated. So she's a pedophile. Like, let's be real clear here. And the media will not call Ghislaine Maxwell a pedophile. She is a pedophile and a sex trafficker. And all the women that survived said Maxwell treated them horribly. She treated them like trash.
Well, I mean, speaking of these political connections, one thing that I was really interested in asking you is that, the connections to the Mossad, because you mentioned it briefly at the beginning. If I recall correctly, Brunel, he had one of these modeling agency offices in Tel Aviv, right? And we've heard many times that Maxwell is connected to the Mossad. Could you explain what that connection is and how this relates to the intelligence, specifically U.S. and Israeli?
Maxwell's father was a Mossad agent, and he had a mysterious death, jumped off a boat or some very sort of odd, mysterious death. So you have that. Then you have, as I stated earlier, Acosta said in an interview in 2009 that he was told to go easy on the prosecution of Epstein in Florida because he was this is Acosta's words, not mine, a quote CIA asset. Right. And then you have, again, John Kiriakou said this in my interview with him, and I asked him about the CIA. I said, does the CIA condone getting children for pedophiles? He goes, no, but if you went, I'm going to get a child for this pedophile because if I get him children, then we can leverage that and use him as an asset. The CIA would go, okay, because they just want the leverage and the intel. And then seeing how, again, going back to Epstein's like fake hedge fund, these guys would donate money to it. And I'm blanking on the names. There was another big hedge fund guy. I can't keep track of all their names, but he donated or invested a lot of money with Epstein, and then women have spoken out against him. So what intelligence is doing, they needed people like Epstein to help them get leverage on all of these people. And they were like, look, Epstein, we'll let him have, you know, do whatever he wants on his plane and on his island as long as he keeps feeding us intel. Until he kept getting, I think Epstein was one of these guys that was so egregious with it that then he became a problem and they got rid of him. From the intelligence standpoint, if they've got video of somebody or some evidence, then that person's easy to control. If that person is found guilty and goes to prison, they don't have them. They don't have, that person has no more power. They have no more leverage. So they need these key people to get all this stuff done. And they've got, you know, leverage on, you know, the Saudi royal family. They've got, and you know, as I said, John Kiriakou said, this feels like the Israelis. He felt like Mossad, his first gut instinct as a former CIA operative was that Mossad was involved in Epstein's death. This all feels very coordinated and maneuvered by those two intelligence agencies.
There is one really important aspect, though, that the victims themselves have underscored, which is that Jeffrey Epstein used these girls to blackmail powerful people. And so, yes, Epstein and Ghislaine are very obviously depraved individuals who preyed on others. But they also did this to get dirt on the wealthy, on politicians, on businessmen, and anyone that mattered. And they did this in service of Israeli intelligence. They did this at the behest of the Mossad. And again, that's not only speculation. This is now confirmed. It's on the record, confirmed by former Israeli intelligence officials, as we were just going through. And so in addition to all of the already vile, deplorable sexual assaults that this entire saga is mired with, we can see now that there is very clearly a political dimension to it as well. And the fact that the media won't talk about this and never tackle this angle, it really speaks volumes, right? Why do they refuse to talk about this? And how come, despite unsealing so many documents, the courts still continue to keep many of them under wraps? What are they hiding from us exactly? And what could be the other dark secrets in the spy world that we're yet to discover? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
The Google employees were not only disturbed by the fact that by entering into this agreement with the Zionist regime, their company became directly involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but were equally outraged by the disturbing pattern of militarization that saw similar contracts between Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and other tech giants with the U.S. military, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and other policing agencies. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ramzi Barut, journalist. This article is published under the heading The Billion-Dollar Deal That Made Google and Amazon Partners in Zionist Regime Occupation of Palestine. Here's the story. Anonymous because we fear retaliation. This text was part of a letter signed by 500 Google employees last October in which they decried their company's direct support for the Zionist regime and the Zionist regime's military. In this letter, the signatories protested a $1.2 billion contract between Google, Amazon Web Services, AWS, and the Zionist regime, which provides cloud services for the Zionist regime's military and cabinet that allows for further surveillance of an unlawful data collection on Palestinians and facilitates expansion of the Zionist regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian land. This is called Project Nimbus. The project was announced in 2018 and went into effect in May 2021, in the first week of the Zionist regime's war on besieged Gaza, which killed over 250 Palestinians and wounded many more. The Google employees were not only disturbed by the fact that, by entering into this agreement with the Zionist regime, their company became directly involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but were equally outraged by the disturbing pattern of militarization that saw similar contracts between Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and other tech giants, with the U.S. military, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and other policing agencies. In an article published in the Nation newspaper in June, three U.S. academics have revealed the financial components of Amazon's decision to get involved in such an immoral business, arguing that such military-linked contracts have become a major source of profit for Amazon. It is estimated, according to the article, that AWS alone was responsible for 63% of Amazon's profits in 2020. The maximum people before profit cannot be any more appropriate than in the Palestinian context, and neither Google nor Amazon can claim ignorance. The Zionist regime occupation of Palestine has been in place for decades, and numerous United Nations resolutions have condemned the Zionist regime for its occupation, colonial expansion, and violence against Palestinians.